Please pray for the work of Apologetic Press. You know, we're a nonprofit organization, and we depend upon, as the School of Preaching does, on churches and individuals that want to assist in the work. We are now in our 32nd year, I guess, 32 years, and a lot of things have happened over that time, but the Lord has blessed that organization and kept it operative. And we really encourage you, if you do not do so, to go to the website, because that's specifically designed to help the church and to help young people in particular with their schooling and to write their papers, all kinds of free material there, and entire ebooks that you can download. We, being a nonprofit organization, we would really like to offer everything that we print free of charge, but we just can't do that. But we definitely have them probably, I would say, about a third of market value, all of our materials. So please take advantage of that. Use it as an evangelistic tool to help the people that you encounter. It may be hard to discuss some matter with a person, but you can say, will you please go to this site and look at this article, and it'll talk about the very thing that you're wanting to know about. So, Lord willing, we'll try to continue doing that work, and any encouragement that you're able to give, we appreciate. There's some free catalogs up here and a few issues of Reason and Revelation for those of you that may wish to have a copy. Okay, this topic of whether or not Genesis is myth or history is not a new topic, is it? It's been going on for a number of years. So far as I can tell, the fellow that kind of popularized this notion was this German theologian, Rudolf Bultmann, who shortly after World War II, kind of the neo-Orthodox theology that was popular at the time. He's the one that wrote the book that talks about demythologizing the New Testament. One of his books was titled Jesus Christ and Mythology. And the idea there is that there are supernatural elements in the New Testament and the Old Testament that you have to just kind of clear out of the way to get to the truth of what's being said. The term myth is really used by theologians to refer to the idea that when primitive peoples are writing their history, you know, they put in some pretty outlandish things, these kind of myths, because from their cultural viewpoint, from their very limited perspective, that's what they think happened. So we have to kind of adjust that in order to really get at the kernel of the truth there. It is absolutely astounding that this swath that was cut through Christendom and theology by these theologians, which changes every few years, you know, a whole new system comes along. This is so typical of humans, is it not? Especially tragic in view of the fact that the Bible is not that difficult to understand. God wrote it in such a way that the average person can arrive at the truths that that person needs to know in order to be saved and to live the Christian life. But there it infiltrates our own brotherhood. We send off our young fellows probably back in the 60s and 70s, send them off to seminaries and centers of higher education where they, probably the vast majority of them, were unquestionably tainted by their education. Then they went back to our Christian universities, and I don't mean to sound like Mr. Gloom and Doom, but I believe we've lost most of our schools. Just as they did in the 1800s when we had over 30 Christian colleges, Hiram, Butler, you know, what is today TCU, a host of these. And we, after that digression of the late 1800s, early 1900s, we had lost, I think, all but seven of those. Well, it's just happening all over again. And the people that put in their hard time, money, effort, resources, talent to build up these universities, and now these universities have lived to turn against the very thing that they were founded to be and do. What a tragedy. The only certainty is the Church of our Lord and the eternal truths that God has given us, and we must not tie our confidence and our sense of stability to human enterprise, should we, even if undertaken initially for good motives and good purposes. It's hard to believe that back in the 1980s, it was discovered that two professors were openly teaching evolution, raw organic evolution in their classrooms, Abilene Christian. And of course, the school immediately mobilized. Most of you were alive then, perhaps read, kept up with the ongoing interaction, and boy, the school mobilized to deny it, brought the board into it. Everybody's rubber stamped it. Yeah, we don't do that here. And then I remember as the dust was finally settling and they managed to squeak by, I remember getting a copy of a publication by the ICR people out in El Cajon, California. They didn't have any dog in the race, no horse in the race. They weren't biased. But they were invited to come to Abilene in order to conduct one of their creation seminars. And in this little publication that I got, they said, hey, we went to Abilene Christian. You know, it has a strong tradition of Christian teaching. But, and we didn't encounter any indication among the professors of evolution per se, but it was evident that a number of the science professors believed in an old earth. Here was an outside organization invited by them to their campus. They look the situation over and they conclude, yeah, that's what you all believe in. And that was what the whole argument was about. The whole discussion was simply about, you need to own up to the fact that your professors believe in long earth so that they can accommodate evolution rather than a young earth. And they never would admit it, and they haven't admitted it to this day. The fact of the matter is, that's not the only campus where evolution's been taught in our brotherhood. It's been taught and is being taught in science departments in other Christian universities. So it's amazing, even shocking, to see the extent to which the authority of the biblical text in general and the book of Genesis in particular has been undermined in the minds of the average American and even among our own people, especially in the last half century. And you know, as you look out across our country, you see little glimpses, little glimmers of really what is beneath the drive to take our country off into degradation. We talked last night about the family and the home. That's surely a major factor in the decline of our civilization. Another one is the fact that the Bible, the integrity of the Bible, the inspiration of the Bible, the authority of the Bible has been under literally incessant attack for over a century now. Just gradually chipping away at public confidence in the text of the Bible and its normative value for daily living. You see little indications of that, for example, when President Bush, just before he left office, was interviewed by Cynthia McFadden on ABC's Nightline, and she asked him point blank, do you take the Bible literally? Is it literally true? He hum-hawed around and said, probably not. Probably not. I'm not a literalist. I think you can learn a lot from it, but not literal. You know, I wish he would have looked her in the face and when she asked that question, should you take the Bible literally? I wish he had looked her in the face and said, well, should I take your question literally? In other words, you've just communicated meaning to me. Can I understand it? Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Duh. So you don't think God can communicate to us in His Word? God's incapable of doing what we do constantly with each other? Whenever these people spew out all of this stuff about, oh, the Bible's not literal and, you know, you've got different meanings and you have your meanings and I have my meanings, and then they expect us to understand what they're saying. Error is always self-contradictory, inconsistent, and by the way, hypocritical. Error is hypocritical. It always is. She also asked him on that occasion what he thought about creation and evolution. And he said, well, I think you can have both. The creation of the world is so mysterious, it requires something as large as an almighty. I don't think it's incompatible with the scientific proof that there is evolution. Well, you know, bless his heart, generally a more conservative national leader than certainly what we have now. But obviously his whole life, he's a baby boomer like me, and much of his life has been exposed to this gradual erosion of confidence and certainty about the biblical text. That's the world in which we now live. That's the culture in which we live. And so people do not have a difficulty speaking of the Bible as not being literal, saying, well, you know, the Bible's figurative and it's got some myth and legend and folklore in it. Well, such are the degrading effects of skepticism, atheism, evolution, and liberal theology that have run rampant and roughshod over our civilization. What a far cry from our history. In fact, it's hard to believe that up until the 1960s, American education was thoroughly saturated with the biblical account of creation. Have you gone back and looked at textbooks from the 1940s back? Going all the way back to the beginning, one of the prominent ones was the New England Primer. They made no bones about it. God created everything in 6 days, and all of that was very good, referring to Genesis 2. Books like the Elementary Spelling Book, which was actually written by one of our founders, Noah Webster, came right out and said those kinds of things. This is the books of public school for most of our history have been laced with Bible and the biblical worldview of the book of Genesis. Genesis was taken as a straightforward account of the formation of the universe and the beginning of human history. And people used to take God at his word. That doesn't mean that our country's always been what it ought to be. It doesn't mean that people never sinned. But generally speaking, embedded into our civilization has been the idea that the Bible's understandable, it's true, it's God's word, and that's what people must acknowledge. Even though liberal theology swept Europe in the late 19th century, which included a lot of attacks on the verbal and inerrant inspiration of the scripture, and even though our own country began to feel its effects. You remember I mentioned in 1925 in Dayton, Tennessee, the Scopes trial over the question of evolution. And yet, most Americans, right up to World War II, continue to understand that the biblical account of creation is an accurate, straightforward, literal account. But folks, sinister forces chipping away at belief and inspiration and the integrity of the Bible, they have succeeded in eroding confidence in its trustworthiness and authority. But you know, as sad and tragic as that is, we have no reason to be dejected. There are no excuses. The evidence is available, and it is overwhelming. No one can stand before God at the end of time and justify themselves for their rejection of Genesis as a straightforward record of literal history. Failure to take Genesis at face value will inevitably result in acceptance of views and practices that will jeopardize a person standing with God, but no one can stand before God and offer legitimate reason why they've done that. Let's go to our New Testaments first and look at how many times we get indication after indication that the New Testament writers understood Genesis to be straightforward history. It is incredible how much the New Testament does this. Depending upon how you calculate the material, the New Testament has at least 60 allusions to the first 11 chapters, which have been under heaviest attack, and over 100 allusions to the entire book of Genesis found in the New Testament. Clearly, Jesus and the writers of the New Testament understood Genesis as literal history. In fact, every New Testament author refers to Genesis. And almost every New Testament book has a reference to Genesis. Not all of them, I think about three do not. But all of the writers do. Their handling of the Genesis account demonstrates they consider those events to have actually occurred. They were not mythological fairy tales. They were actual historical events. For example, you remember in Matthew chapter 19 in the parallel in Mark 10 when Jesus is discussing a response to the question, can a man divorce his reason for his wife for any reason? He quotes Genesis 1:27 and 2:24 and uses those as historical precedent and proof that carte blanche divorce is unacceptable to God. So he was using those passages as historical, not as fairy tales. Jesus did not ground his answer regarding marriage and divorce in fairy tales and legends. That would be silly. These were actual events that serve as prototypical information. They're normative for human behavior today. What about Matthew chapter 23? You remember as Jesus was pronouncing the demise of the Jewish Commonwealth, and he mentioned Abel as a real person whose blood was shed because of his righteous behavior. And then he proceeded to refer to, you know, all the righteous blood shed from Abel to Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom the Jews murdered between the temple and the altar. Question, is the temple historical? Is the altar historical? Is there an actual geographical location between those two? Was Zechariah an actual historical person? Well, of course. Then so was Abel, whose literal hemoglobin was shed by his brother. What about John chapter 8, verse 44, where Jesus said, Satan is a murderer from the beginning and the father of lies. He was referring to Genesis chapter 3 in the fall. He literally murdered Adam and Eve. Well, now there's figurative language, right? He didn't literally murder them, not physically, but he did spiritually. What about John chapter 5, verses 46 and 47, where Jesus referenced Moses' writings as genuine representations of history? What about Matthew 24? Jesus spoke, talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and so forth. He spoke of the days of Noah, as it was back in the days of Noah, and the flood as an actual historical event, and said, you know, just like people were living then and doing certain things then, whenever Jesus comes, it's going to be that way. People are going to be living and doing certain things. Well, that parallel is clearly intended to be historical. Matthew chapter 11, when he was pronouncing a woe upon Capernaum, he said, if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, Sodom never would have been burned off the face of the earth. It'd still be here with us today. Well, a fairy tale city can't be with you today. It would have to have been an actual city. The genealogical lists in both Matthew 1 and Luke 3 that take us back to Adam in one of those cases, it includes the names of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, Tamar, Seth, Enoch, Noah, Adam. That puts us right back into Genesis. Further evidence that Jesus understood the Genesis account to be actual history. Moving to Paul, when you look at Paul's letters, here's a sampling of his allusions to Genesis, which clearly indicate he understood it to be literal history. 2 Corinthians 4:6, he quoted Genesis 1:3, let there be light, to make the point that God caused light to shine out of darkness. That's literal. That actually happened. 1 Corinthians 15:45, he quoted Genesis 2:7, where he said Adam was the first human being on earth. You know, we have our own brethren who say that's not true. John Clayton, for years and years, has said that man is a Johnny-come-lately on the planet, and we're not to understand literal history as occurring over those millions of years. 1 Corinthians 15:47, he claimed that Adam was made from dust. That's actual history. 1 Corinthians 11, we mentioned yesterday that the woman was taken out of the man, which is literally what happened whenever she was created from Adam's body. What about 1 Corinthians 6:16, where in quoting Genesis 2:24, he verifies that a man and a woman become one flesh. And then over in Ephesians 5, he compared that marriage to the church. Said there are parallels here. And what about Romans chapter 5, where, again, Adam was just as historically real as Christ and Moses. He introduced sin into the world. He caused death to reign during an historical interval, which he describes as from Adam to Moses. So from Adam to Moses, sin reigned. Is that all literal history? Was there really an Adam, really a Moses, and really an actual historical period in between? 1 Timothy chapter 2, he identifies Adam and Eve by name, says that Adam was created before the woman was created, and mentions the deception to which Eve succumbed, and even mentions the serpent, the snake, and he mentions him again in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. What about Romans chapter 1, verse 20, where he says that God's deity, you know that term that's translated Godhead, and the fact that he's all-powerful. These attributes have been seen by whom and for how long? He says from the beginning of the creation. People have been seeing this. coming to the conclusion, there's a God, look at this. Well, that goes all the way back to Adam and Eve right at the very beginning of time. That's 1 Corinthians 15, or sorry, Romans chapter 1, verse 20. In Romans 15, verse 8, Paul said that Jesus fulfilled the promises that had been made to the fathers. Well, that's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all personages mentioned in the book of Genesis. And then in Romans chapter 9, verse 9, Paul quoted the promise that God had made to Abraham concerning Sarah giving birth to Isaac, and then mentioned Jacob, Esau, and Rebekah all by name. In Romans chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. So Jesus took the book of Genesis as a true account of history. Paul did the same thing. So did Peter. In 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, you remember he referred to the watery mass at the creation, where the water was above and below, and it was separated by God. That takes it right into creation week. What about 1 Peter 3:20 and 2 Peter 2:5, where the flood is an actual historical event? He mentions Noah by name. He specifies the number of survivors of the flood as 8, and the flood itself in extent was global. 2 Peter 3:6. What about 2 Peter 2, verses 6 through 9, where he believed in the historical personage of Lot, and that God actually turned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly? That's not after a fairy tale has been revealed. That's a historical event, and everybody who's lived since that historical event has looked back at that and said, look what God did when he obliterated 4 of those 5 cities off the surface of the earth. He then mentions the purpose of understanding that and why God did it. God knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. So if that incident was not historical, it serves no legitimate parallel purpose. Really renders the New Testament of no value. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 6, Peter said that the relationship between Sarah and Abraham was an actual historical relationship. Then we move, so notice that's Jesus, Paul, and Peter. That's most of the New Testament. What about the writer of the Hebrew letter? You're well aware of the fact that his entire argument in the book depends upon the historicity of Genesis. Hebrews depends upon that. For example, in chapter 1, verse 10, he quotes Psalm 102 and includes the fact that even as God created the heavens and the earth, so they will perish. That's literal historicity. What about chapter 4? Where he alludes to the fact that God finished his creation, his creative activities, a direct reference to Genesis 2:1. And then he actually quotes Genesis 2:2 to call attention to the fact that after God created for 6 days, then on the seventh, he ceased. The Hebrew word rested, ceased his actions on day 7. What about Hebrews chapter 5? A good portion of that chapter talks about this historical character, Melchizedek, in contrast with Aaron. That demands that both Aaron and Melchizedek are actual historical people. Also, Hebrews chapter 6, where God's promise to Abraham back in Genesis 22 is a literal promise to a literal person. What about Hebrews 11, verse 3? By faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God. So, even as Genesis indicates, God said, he spoke it. Come over to Hebrews. The Hebrews writer verifies that that's actual history. What about the rest of Hebrews 11, a veritable who's who of historical personalities from Genesis? How about Cain, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, who literally produced a multitude of descendants? Did millions of people come from her? Yes. Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. In chapter 12, Esau sold his birthright for food. Is that a fairy tale, a legend? In Genesis? No, the Hebrews writer said that really happened. And Abel's shed blood is as historically real as Christ's blood in chapter 12, verse 24. So that's Jesus, Paul, Peter, the writer of Hebrews. What about the other writers of the New Testament? Well, look at James chapter 2, verse 21, where he refers in discussing faith to Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. Look at Jude, where he mentions Cain, Enoch, Sodom, and Gomorrah. What about John in 1 John chapter 3, verse 12, where he says Cain murdered his brother because of his own sinful actions? Even the book of Revelation. Now, you want to try to stake your case on everything's figurative in the Bible. Revelation would be the best place to try to launch that little quibble. And yet, that's not to say that we cannot get literal information, literal meaning from Revelation, or that we cannot see that he understands Genesis as being historical. And there are many such indications in that volume. So to suggest that Genesis is actually really just a compilation of fables and folklore and popular anecdotes and myths rather than actual history is to suggest that the doctrines of Christianity are rooted in and dependent on fairy tales and imaginary stories. That is absolutely ludicrous. Let's turn our attention now to linguistic proof that Genesis is literal history. So not only the way the New Testament alludes to people and events in the book of Genesis, but think about the actual literary nature of the New Testament and Genesis and its relationship to it. The people that are arguing in our day, and there are a lot of them, that Genesis should not be read as literal history because they say it is written in poetic form. So it's not really a literal description of actual events. That's a bunch of linguistic gobbledygook. Written language, whether from man or God, can be deciphered in terms of the nature of its literary function, how its literature works. You can identify the author's use of linguistic elements. You can extract intended meaning from words that are used. In other words, even though all 50 chapters of Genesis no doubt contain figurative language, in fact, I suppose that every page of the Bible has figurative language. Every speech that we've heard, every lecture that we've heard during this lectureship, I suspect every single person's made use of figurative language, and we are so used to it, we are so clued in to the meaning intended, we didn't even think about it when it came across our ears. But that does not mean that we cannot understand when something is literal or figurative in the Bible. You cannot, over your lifetime, as you've tried to discuss the Bible with people, how many times have you met people who, when you're trying to press some point about the Bible that they need to understand and obey, and they give you that little, well, you know, the Bible's figurative. Just kind of a blanket sweeping, I don't have to deal with the Bible. Well, that is so sad because they'll have a rude awakening one day. Think of the volumes that have been written on human communication, how language functions, even in our own brotherhood. You know, well over a century ago, our brethren wrote books on hermeneutics, how to understand the Bible. The one that we're most familiar with is probably D.R. Dungan, who wrote that in 1888. He has an entire section on figurative language with specific questions on how to detect figurative language. So if you go to a passage like when Jesus told that fellow, he said, I can't come follow you because my dad died and I've got to go bury him. And he said, let the dead bury the dead. Well, there's the word dead in one sentence, one of them being used literally and one being used figuratively. Can you figure that out? Can we understand that? Or are we forever doomed to see the Bible as cryptic and you can't understand it? Well, even though Dungan has formalized these questions, they're self-evident, they're easily understood, even by a six-year-old. So they're not difficult tools to use in order to decipher the Bible in terms of any time you encounter figurative language. It can be done. He has a section called the various figures of the Bible, so he talks about synecdoche and metonymy and hyperbole and simile and metaphor and all of those. He has a section called Figures of Thought. You know, another Restoration personality that wrote a book on hermeneutics that we're not as familiar with and probably don't use in our schools of preaching, written in 1901 by Clinton Longhart, entitled Principles of Interpretation, in some ways, I suppose, a more scholarly treatment. He has sections on figurative language, poetry, and types. And then, of course, outside churches of Christ, there have been a host of books written, like all the way back in 1883, Bernard Ram's Hermeneutics, and Milton, that's more recently, Milton Terry's book in 1883 was called Biblical Hermeneutics. So the whole notion of determining is the creation account poetry, is it hymn, is it myth, or is it describing literally what happened? Not necessarily in scientific terminology, but in straightforward, ordinary language. That is not the impossible enterprise that it has been made out to be, unless a person has an agenda and they want to concoct an elaborate smokescreen in order to avoid the obvious import of God's word. Turn with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 1, and let's underscore this a little bit more vividly. Does Genesis chapter 1 contain any figurative language? And if so, can we identify it and understand what is being said? Absolutely. Look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. Look in your English version at the term face. In the original language, this term is actually in plural, panim, faces. And if you go to these various writers who have spent their life analyzing human language and categorizing it in terms of figures of speech and figurative language, you know, they put these $50 terms on what this is. And don't let those throw you off, because that's just a way to classify language. But this is an actual instance, an idiomatic instance of pleonasm, a form of amplificatio. You know, the Latin word for amplifying something. That's how it functions. The idea here is that words are used, more words are used than the grammar actually requires. Darkness was upon the faces of the deep, is what is literally said. Notice that the word deep is a figurative word for sea or ocean. Okay, we can figure that out, can't we? But on top of that, by using, instead of simply saying darkness was upon the deep, darkness was upon the ocean, by saying darkness was upon the faces of the deep, grammatically that makes the statement more forcible and more emphatic. But there's nothing there that you can't understand or that you cannot see the literal meaning that's intended. Look at verse 4. And how this figure of speech is repeated in verse 10, 12, 18, 21, 25. The idea of saw, S-A-W, God saw. Well, that's the figure of speech known as anthropopathia, in which human attributes are ascribed to God. In this case, human actions. So God saw. That's not to say that God has physical eyeballs that are made of flesh like ours, but we understand the meaning that is intended. Look at the expression in verses 9 and 10. Let the dry appear. Literally, the Hebrew has, let the dry appear. Let the dry appear. That's the figure of speech known as antimereia, the exchange of one part of speech for another, in this case, an adjective for a noun. Now, I realize that sounds a little complicated, but if you had time to sit down and focus your mind and think about it, you'd see it's not that hard to understand. So the word dry is referring to the land. And you could just as easily insert, you know, the word land alone and leave dry off and still understand what God was communicating. Look at verse 11. Polypteton is the figure of speech here, where the same part of speech is repeated in a different inflection. Specifically, the verb seeding is repeated by means of its cognate noun, seed. Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed. Well, literally, it's seeding seed. Well, that's not really an American English way of talking, so the translators make it understandable and clear. So that point there is that vegetation was created by God in a state of bearing seed, not vice versa, which, by the way, has implications for whether or not evolution is true. That militates against the notion that evolution, well, the instantaneous nature of creation, God created full grown with seed capability. So, is there figurative language in those first, 10 verses, 11 verses that we looked at? Yeah, really quite a bit. But that doesn't mean that you cannot understand the literal meanings that's intended to be conveyed by that creation week. In fact, look at these terms in Genesis chapter 1. I just went down the chapter and pulled out words that no one has any trouble understanding are literal. What about the word earth? Is that talking about Venus, Mars, or no planet? That's talking about the planet Earth. What about darkness versus light? What about Spirit of God? What about waters? What about night? What about evening, morning? What about first, seas, grass, herb, seed, fruit, tree, seasons, years, stars, fowl, fish, cattle? Oh yeah, that's all literal. Day, hold it. Day is just as literal as light, night, waters, evening, morning. There's no reason to tamper with day unless you have an agenda and have been influenced by the times in which we live. So distinguishing between figurative and literal language is not that difficult. There's a fellow that's part of this ICR group, the Rate. I don't know if you ever looked at that book, the Rate team. They went back and studied dating techniques that the evolutionists used to show that they're bogus. He did a study of Genesis chapter 1:1 through chapter 2, verse 3. Very complicated statistical analysis. And his purpose was to determine whether this account is to be taken literally or figuratively. Here's the conclusion he came to. The biblical creation account clearly is not poetry, but instead is a literal description in real time of supernatural events. All right, now let's look at some corroboration by other passages, and then we will conclude. Many passages scattered from the Old and the New Testament allude to the events of the book of Genesis as if they are, in fact, historical accounts. One of those is the fact, as we've already emphasized quite a bit, is that God literally, orally spoke the universe into existence. Go back to Exodus chapter 20 and put yourself in that setting where here we are approximately 1500 BC. Moses, the Israelites have come out of Egypt. They're camped at the base of Mount Sinai. Moses has gone up to receive the laws that would govern this new theocracy. And you remember in conveying this information from God, Moses informs the Israelites that one of the things they're going to do is to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you will labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you will do no work. Now so far, you know, if you're a Jew standing there listening to that, you understand what he means. We're going to work Sunday through Friday, but Saturday we're not to do any work. Any problem understanding that? For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that's in them, and rested or ceased on the seventh. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now there is no Jew that would ever get the idea that when he made that latter statement about God creating everything in 6 days and not working on the seventh, that somehow that was referring to millions and billions of years. They'd never get that idea. It's clearly, a setting is clearly indicated that is literal, unmistakably. Another example in Psalm 33, verses 6 through 9, that speaks of the word of the Lord and the breath of his mouth and his speaking and commanding and all of the universe coming into existence. You know, God could have spoken everything into existence in 6 seconds, couldn't he, instead of 6 days. He could have spoken everything into existence in 6 milliseconds. And on we could go with that. But he chose to do it a specific way and then communicate that to us. And now people want to argue, well, we really can't understand what he communicated. There's nothing definite about it. That is simply not true. The oral aspect of God speaking the physical realm into existence is literal. In fact, if you work your way on through the Bible, you see God speaking, and that's literal. How about Genesis chapter 12, where he spoke to Abraham? Chapter 22. What about Exodus 3 at the burning bush? Did he speak to Moses or not? What about Matthew chapter 3, where at the baptism of Jesus, and then the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew 17, where the voice of God boomed forth. Did he really speak? Well, of course he did. In Psalm 148, we have this lengthy section here talking about the psalmist calling upon the inanimate created order to give praise to God because, according to that passage, he commanded and they were created. So what's the figurative part of that? Well, the sun and the moon and the stars are not actually going to start singing a hymn to God.